sleep, mother. Don't want to go to sleep.
And do me a favor. Don't disturb my friend. He's dead tired.
Well, what the hell are you saying, Doss? You bruised half your body sleeping.
I sleep pretty hard.
Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
Hey, it's Brian.
And hey, it's Murdoch. Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
Remember, you get involved in the show. It's wearethestoryguys@gmail.com. Marta writes the show. She says, Lenny Kravitz came up in conversation the other day with a group of friends, as he often does. Someone mentioned that he once had an affair with Madonna. Is that true? I'd never heard that before. Okay, let's start here, Murdoch. Who's hotter, Lenny Kravitz or Madonna?
Lenny Kravitz. So first, I've seen Madonna completely nude, like all the way. And the only thing I've seen with Lenny was that there was this, it was a festival somewhere and his pants came undone and everything came out of his pants.
Oh my God.
It was one of those things. Also, when that first record came out, Let Love Rule, I was in the Lenny Kravitz fan club in 1988 or 89.
Are you serious?
Yeah, and they sent out a mailer, like a a paper mailer that was Xerox.
That's amazing. I did not know that about you, and that sets you up as the prime audience for this story today, because where we are headed is to Let Love Rule, or a little bit after Let Love Rule. It's really interesting, though. Yeah. We're going to cite his autobiography, Let Love Rule. He also wrote not only the album, he also has a book called that. And I don't know if... Did you read the book?
I didn't read the book, but that first record was just phenomenal, which he produced.
Right.
And then I loved the second record, too, which obviously was a smash.
So, a fun thing about the autobiography, it stops after he releases Let Love Rule. Like, it's only up... Like, he wrote it, like, in the last 10 years, but he only covers up to, like, 1990 in the book. And then he's just out.
Wow.
Yeah, which I thought was a really interesting choice. I mean, I guess that leads you to a multi-book deal, which may mean more money, but you don't typically see someone just be like, I'm just running through my first record. Okay, so all joking or not joking aside about who's the hottest, let's jump right in to the core of this question. Lenny, Madonna, were they ever a sexual thing?
They both say no.
Okay.
That's what they say, but I always heard that it was a thing.
Okay.
So,
yeah, who knows, right? Madonna has had a lot of relationships of all lengths, all puns intended. And B, there is a reason that your friend Marta, speaking directly to you, thinks that they were a thing and that a lot of the world thinks they were a thing. And it's less about the fact that they're both so stinking hot and more about something really hot that they did together, which is a song in this case.
And it got sultry, controversial, and weird all at once, and that's Justify My Love.
Justify My Love. Lenny Kravitz has said this about the recording, okay? So take this for what you want, Marta. Quote, it was
meow,
just...
Meow, 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 meow. I like this quote.
It was just the two of us, and he's referring to Lenny and Madonna, and my engineers, and it happened in one day, and it was very quick, and there are details about that session that I cannot tell you, but it was fun. It was fun and very sensual.
There are details I can't tell you. Always is like, yeah, whatever, dude. So
when you call me, that's typically how it is. When you call me, you're like, how was that that 112th Third Eye Blind concert you went to? And my response is typically, there are details I can't tell you. Mostly because you don't care about what covers they did. But yes, let's parse this out.
Core characters here that we need to talk about, super important before we dive in. We've got Lenny and Madonna. There's a third person. And it's a figure from 80s and 90s. A lot of people may not know who it is. She's a Mexican-American poet and muse, and her name's Ingrid Chavez.
Yeah, and we have to timeline this so we can understand where we are. So I just mentioned getting up to a little bit past Let Love Rule. Let's talk about where we are in each of these people's careers, though. And to put a distinct map on it, I guess we just start with the song. Do you want to start there?
Justify My Love is 1990. It actually was released towards the end of the year, November 6th. And she had a greatest hits collection. If you don't remember, it's called the Immaculate Collection.
Right.
And it was the single that was on that.
Okay, so this serves to tell us very quickly where we are in Madonna's career, right? She's a big enough presence and star to have a greatest hits collection. So, boom, there you go. Give us like a 1-2-3 recap on Madonna. I don't think we've ever talked about her at length on the show, so just sort of let's get there real fast.
Yeah, yeah. And it was the late 70s, 78. She dropped out of University of Michigan. She moved to New York. She was a backup dancer, a bunch of different artists. She met this guy named Dan Gilroy, and they started a band called The Breakfast Club. Funny.
And then she starts another band with another boyfriend, and this one they call Emmy and the Emmys. So she's in two bands like before the 80s.
I like Emmy and the Emmys. You know, when Lemmy turned 60, Metallica did a concert where they all dressed up like him, and they were the Lemmys. Yeah, but by 81, she's doing a solo career. She okay. knows she's a star. The star caliber is, like, all over her. So she gets management instead of instead of shopping demos to record labels and radio stations. And she goes to dance clubs and DJs just to try to get her records played in nightclubs. And that's a key thing for her.
I know. This is really fascinating to me, right? Because most of these stories we talk about on this show, there's this traditional path of, depending on the decade, about how you get notoriety. Now, of course, it's the internet. For a long time, it was radio. But it's interesting to me that her strategy is nightclubs, because she wants her songs to be things that people dance to. And so one of these DJs will get her a meeting with Seymour Stein of Sire Records.
And that's enough to get her on American Bandstand, which I watched when that was on TV. And wow, that was awesome. And she was on Top of the Pops on the other side of the pond. This is 84. That's that first big record for her. That's when you get to see her.
And that's important. What was... Right.
Yeah.
That's important, not just because of the sex appeal thing that we've talked about, right, with her and Lenny both, but it's fashion. It's really fashion with both of them to a certain degree, especially early on. But I loved this. I stumbled upon this, and I feel like we have to do a little side quest here. 5-minute primer on a very important rock and roll side character. Let's talk about Maripol.
Yeah, there's an argument that the average person thinks of an 80s fashion as all or mostly dear to Maripol, which most people have no idea who this is. So huge influence on the iconography of the whole decade, really.
So she's Moroccan. She comes to New York City in the late 70s, brings along with her a Polaroid camera.
She's a designer, art director, but more than that, she inserts herself in the nightlife in Manhattan and makes some very important friends.
Yeah, friends like Basquiat, Keith Haring, Andy Warhol. And Basquiat, we're just narrowing the view there. He's a graffiti artist, if you're not familiar, rises to prominence during this time. But he dates Madonna for a while. I've said dates Madonna 3 times already, and we're like very early in this. Early 80s. And so the circles start to converge when it comes time to style Madonna, when she's going to do these TV appearances and start to make singles and record sleeves. And Maripol's in the circle, and so she is like, oh, I'll help make decisions on what you're going to look like, Madonna.
But, you know, to the earlier point about her influence, Madonna is not the only artist she will actually style, so that you'll understand her influence. She worked with Grace Jones.
Yep.
She worked with Debbie Harry,
yep,
which was a huge thing in the early 80s when you see how much fashion in her and Blondie and the band and what that became. You can see the commonalities. You can see her heavy band and what we think of 80s fashion, especially when you think of everything that was going on in New York in the early 80s.
Right. And so those early TV performances, they really matter because they get her seen and people see this fashion that's coming out of New York, right? And it spreads across the country, mass media, right? But there is another TV performance that really puts her on the map in a way that will become impossible for mainstream people to ignore.
Yeah, and that's from MTV.
Okay. So first album does okay, Holiday, Borderline, Lucky Star. But it's the second album and its title track and the ire it induces from the conservative crowd that will really set her path.
Yeah. And so second record, big record, was Like a Virgin. So
I learned real fact. I learned Like a Virgin, the song. Did not know about it as a young child. Learned about it because of Weird Al's Like a Surgeon and then went backwards.
That's how you learned it, man.
And I was like, wait. What were the original lyrics of this song? 9-year-old me freaking out. Yeah, that actually happened.
Really, I love the really dorky parts about you.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
I'm just saying. I mean, I was watching Cinemax and Showtime at the same time, but I didn't understand at the 84 MTV Video Music Awards what any of this, like, what was happening.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So I'm 10. I don't know what a virgin is, and I didn't know at all what the writhing around in the wedding dress on the floor meant, other than, what's this chick? I know the song, but why is she just rolling around the floor?
She's going to get that white dress really dirty. What is happening?
Over my head. Yeah.
Okay, so from here, from this exposure on MTV and this, you know, just like sort of rocks the world when people see this, things really start to explode for her, right? So Material Girl will happen now. Then she'll marry Sean Penn, which is a thing I totally forgot about, but is a big part of her early career.
Wow.
That, of course, turns bad by the end of the decade, but in the meantime, she's getting into movies and Broadway. I forget also that she had a Broadway career in the 80s. And she has the most number one and top 10 hit songs by a woman in both the United States and the United Kingdom in the end of the 80s and becomes a pop culture icon. So 1990, it makes logical sense that she would release a greatest hits record, which gets us back to where we were.
Good place to make a pause button and then pivot to Lenny. Right? Yeah.
Okay, so do you think people know about Lenny's showbiz pedigree?
I maybe, but it's so fun to talk about. His mom is Roxy Roker, so that means he's cousins with Al Roker, but that's not the cool
dude
part,
that's a short right? That's short end of the stick. Poor Al Roker. Man, can you imagine your cousin is Lenny Kravitz? You're like this squat sort of like comic relief character on television and then you're like, yeah, my cousin's Lenny Kravitz. Yeah, don't bring him around. Right, don't come to the parties, man. You're totally blocking my vibe.
But Lenny's super cool. His mom was Helen Willis on The Jeffersons, which is one of my favorite shows as a kid, for sure.
She's part of the first interracial couple to be portrayed on television, ever.
Mm-hmm.
And also part of an interracial couple in real life, because she is with Cy Kravitz, who was a big-time TV producer who worked at NBC News for a long time.
Yeah, and this is where Sandler would jump in with the Hanukkah song and half Jewish. So Cy is not only, that means Lenny is half Jewish. Cy is not only a producer, but he's a side gig passion project. He promotes jazz shows. So he knew Miles Davis, Count Basie, Ella Fitzgerald. And the legend goes that he's really good friends with Duke Ellington, who personally sang him happy birthday for his fifth birthday.
Yeah, so this is a story Lenny has told his whole career, right? That, you know, Uncle Duke came over. This guy grows up as, this is basically what you're saying, is there's tons of resources for him, right? It's not like he lacks resources, but he also is around a lot of music. So there's a musical pedigree that sort of he grows up with.
Yeah, Madonna had to put in some work for it, but where Lenny went to Beverly Hills High School, whatever.
Oh, yeah,
Slash, Slash and Nicolas Cage, they went to school with him, too. So
side pause. Everyone who listens to the show knows my favorite actor of all time is Nicolas Cage. I just read Age of Cage, which is a book that chronicles Hollywood for the last 40 years through Nicolas Cage's career, and I give the book high marks. Very, very good. Anyway, proceed.
Oh, no problem. His first attempt in music biz is not very fruitful in the mid-80s. He comes up with a stage name, and I remember this because I was in the fan club, and it was called Romeo Blue.
Were you in the Romeo and Blue wore, fan club, like before he was Lenny Kravitz?
No. I was in the Lenny fan club, but I knew about Romeo Blue.
Okay.
I did not know when he was Romeo Blue that he wore blue contact lenses, which is intense.
I have a neighbor that does that now. It is intense every time I see her.
Yeah, they did get a little bit of attention.
A little bit, right? Sure. And then we're pausing here because this is a very important part of the story. One day during this period of his life, Lenny Kravitz goes to a New Edition concert.
That's right, Mr. Telephone Man. And it's better than that. He tries out to play guitar for New Edition.
Can you imagine if that's how he knew him, as the guitar player from New, like the touring guitar player from New Edition? Okay, him and one of his bandmates, right? They both try out, and New Edition does not hire Lenny Kravitz. So there's a sliding doors moment for you. We love to talk about those. So his friend, though, gets in the band, and so when he makes his debut, they get Lenny a backstage pass for the show, right? He's like, listen, I know you didn't make it into the band, but come hang out with us or whatever, right? A little consolation prize. And that is where, after this New Edition performance, he gets in an elevator to go downstairs to see everybody, and someone comes up as the elevator doors are closing and sticks their hand in the elevator, and it is the person accompanying Lisa Bonet. And Lisa Bonet will walk into the elevator.
So Lenny swears when he was a little younger, he had seen her face on TV Guide and told a pal that he would marry her one day. So when she steps on the elevator, all he really says is, I like your hair.
And this will start what they say at the beginning is just a friendship. Lenny has a fiance, Lisa's in some relationships, and they're just very close friends for the next 2 years.
Yeah, and it's important to remember that Lenny is still a struggling musician. Like, he hasn't hit it, Romeo Blue. He's not famous. But Lisa Bonet is the bona fide TV star.
She's so huge.
Because she's on The Cosby Show, and then she does a movie with De Niro, and then she gets a Cosby Show spinoff with Malcolm Jamal Warner called A Different World.
So were you into Cosby Show, A Different World, or Angel Heart, any of those three?
Yeah, I watched Cosby Show, like I guess a lot of people, and I totally watched Different World. Like, mm-hmm. I just followed them there. And now I was older enough to understand versus the Like a Virgin performance at the VMAs. I watched Angel Heart and understood exactly what was acutely obscene in that for a lot of people.
So I watched Cosby Show growing up every Thursday night. We would have root beer floats and watch the Cosby Show. So that is my tranquil childhood, since we were comparing notes on how different our upbringings were. That was my highlight of my week every week was, yes, you can put some soda in your ice cream after 8 p.m. and we'll watch The Cosby Show together. So there's a lot to say about this relationship, right? It does eventually become romantic, and then it becomes a marriage very quickly. Lisa Bonet's only 20 when they get married. Lenny is slightly older. Yeah. And it becomes tabloid fodder. It's two gorgeous people. They're both eccentric and fashion forward. I mean, I don't know if you remember what Lisa Bonet used to wear, but just like weird hats and stuff.
Yes.
And of course, in 2024, we now have the literal offspring of this relationship, Zoe Kravitz, who has a movie coming out that she directed very soon. And of course, has had a television program and been in a bunch of flicks. The relationship between Lenny and Lisa, for its impact, doesn't actually last that long. It's over as a legal union in the early 90s. But we're interested in mentioning it for a couple of reasons.
First, Lenny basically abandons the band he was working on, and he's creating one once he gets serious with Lisa, because he wants to write songs about his love for her, and it does change his musical focus.
Yeah, so the Lenny we find is not the Lenny. It, like, would have been different without Lisa, because he literally drops everything that he'd been doing. Second, through Lisa, Lenny gets reacquainted with Steve Smith, and he had met Steve when he was a kid, because Steve actually worked in some capacity on the Jeffersons. But now, when Lisa gets her spinoff show, Steve is the music supervisor on A Different World.
And so Lenny starts playing these Lisa-inspired songs for anybody that'll listen. And when Steve hears them, likes them, Lenny gets an idea. He asks Steve to be his manager. And even though Steve doesn't have any experience doing any of that, seems like a good idea at the time.
Well,
right?
It turns out that Steve is able to deliver. So just to cut to the chase, there's a bidding war over Lenny Kravitz, and Lenny will end up choosing Virgin Records. And this is how we get to the album that made you a card-carrying member of Lenny Kravitz's fan club. That's a record called Let Love Rule.
Not an overnight success at all.
Uh-uh.
Totally. He has to work it in the U.S., and he has to tour in Europe, and it's this move that'll kind of connect our stories, what we want to talk about.
Because it is inside a European dance club, to your point, where Lenny Kravitz will start spending time with a woman named Madonna.
And he will say in an interview in the show notes that they started to run in the same circles. She had great parties where everyone would go dancing, and they started spending time together and just got to know each other, maybe as friends.
You know, they say as friends. Now, when he gets back to the U.S. after that first Let Love Rule European tour, he starts writing new songs for himself, because he's working on what you did point out will become the breakthrough record for him. And he has Madonna on his mind a little.
This is from an article in the show notes. This is Lenny talking. I was working on some demos, and Justify My Love came up, and I loved it. And I knew it wasn't for me, Kravitz said. I thought it'd be perfect for Madonna. So I called her and I said, hey, I have a number one song for you. And she said, no, you don't. And I said, yes, I do. Where are you? I'll bring it over. So that same day in New York City, Kravitz finds himself sitting in front of Madonna with the demo for Justify My Love in his hand.
Yeah, and here he continues, quote, I put it in the cassette deck, turned the console up to 10, and out it came. And the whole room got really quiet, and it ended, and Madonna looked at me and said, play it again. So I pushed play, played it again, and she said, let's record it, and I think we started the next day.
I love the let play it again thing, because that's what Butch Vig said to Nirvana when he heard Smells Like Teen Spirit the first time. play it again.
Well, that to me is the mark of a, that's the mark of a good song, right? Like even I, that's how I build my playlists. Little insight here is that if you play me a random song, and this happens all the time when we're together, right? And this happened the other night. Right. We were recording something and I showed you a song and I watched you pull your phone out and put it on a playlist, right? That's, it's, hey, I want to hear that again. So yeah, if you're a producer and you're listening to music for a living and there is a song that draws you back when it ends, that's probably a pretty good sign.
Yeah. But here for everybody else that seriously, there's people that are listening here that may not have heard Justify My Love. So let's talk about that song for a minute.
Okay, well, let me just, I think the easiest way to do this is to read this quote where it was once described in a review as, quote, a spoken word ode to releasing your inner freak.
Yeah. Boring. I'll be honest.
Yeah. I mean, it's
the video was all sex and there was hands and things.
Right. And so stuff, you're right. You can't talk about the song without talking about the video. It's black and white. There's a dominatrix in it. There's drag. 1990s MTV is not ready for it, very literally.
And there was always, we're going to ban your video thing with Madonna and MTV, but up to this point, they just hadn't pulled the trigger.
I know, like all those other songs, they're like, well, I don't think we can play that, and then they come back and play it. It's pretty tempting to assume, though, that they do this on purpose. They try to get this thing banned, because I don't think this song would have been near the hit it was if it hadn't got banned on MTV, because it became a talking point everywhere.
And I remember this, and this seems like ancient history to me. It's such a news story that ABC used to have, ancient history, a news show at night called Nightline. With Ted Koppel, and we're going to show the whole video. They showed the entire video.
So they can't show it on MTV, but they show it on a news, news outlet.
And Madonna will then be able to sell what is essentially the first video single, a $10 VHS tape of a video to a song that probably seemed like it was softcore for some people.
This is part of its success from a numbers standpoint. You can't argue with this because these videos count as singles, right? So the video becomes a huge part of the story of the success of this song, as I said. It's not actually the part we're going to discuss here, though, because there is a controversy that will swell up around the creation of the song itself. I say a controversy. There's actually several controversies that will spring up around how the song was made.
And notice that when Lenny is telling this story on the circuit then or now, he is on the phone pitching this song almost as if he wrote this song all by himself. And that's not true.
I think it's funny because he says, I was going through demos for, like, he skips the creation process when he tells this story. He just says, he basically says, I was listening back to demos instead of saying, here's how we wrote this demo. So as we set up at the top, that brings us to a third very important character in all of this. And that is a woman named Ingrid Chavez. Now, how do you, let me just start the conversation about her here. How do you feel about Graffiti Bridge?
That is not my favorite Prince record.
This is
bottom three.
It's a film and a soundtrack, right? And it's a standalone sequel to Purple Rain. So most people know Purple Rain. At least they know the song. They probably know it was a flick. In general, people hated this film, Graffiti Bridge. Also of interest to us, and I find this just coincidental and funny, Graffiti Bridge officially enters the world within 4 days of Justify My Love. Justify My Love, I think you said it was November 6th up top. This comes out November 2nd, so that's Friday to Tuesday because of the difference between movie releases and music releases at the time.
So like this and Sign of the Times, obviously Prince is the central character person in this film it is. Opposite him, by the way, is the female romantic lead is a lady named Ingrid Chavez.
Now, this is essentially Ingrid's only film credit ever. She was not aiming to be an actress.
Nah.
In fact, I found a recent article about her, and it began this way. Let me read it. Quote, Ingrid Chavez has always been undefinable. Among many other things, she's a poet, a songwriter, a singer, jewelry and apparel designer, photographer, and mother. On that list, not actress. So let's back up and figure out how she gets into this.
There's a great interview in the show notes. It's from 2022 with Ingrid Chavez herself. And so I will just let her carry this part of the story where she's explaining how she ended up meeting Prince, which is always a weird story for everyone involved. This is her quote. I just happened to wind up in Minneapolis. I was in a band with my boyfriend at the time, and we were making all this really dark music because we were into Sushi the Banshees. We came home one day, and someone had broken into our warehouse space and taken all of our equipment. My boyfriend was from Minneapolis, so we sold my car and bought tickets to move there as it made the most sense.
And weird. From there, the story is that she will get settled in Minneapolis. She'll be at a bar one night, and she will see Prince in the bar. And I, like, as you said, anytime anyone meets Prince, it's weird, typically. And so I think, and I've always heard this, because remember, like, a long time ago we had the guy who designed the symbol for Prince on the show. You'll have to go back in the archives and find that. It was a fascinating conversation. And he just sort of, I remember him mentioning, like, that Prince is so fond of Minneapolis that he makes himself just a resident of Minneapolis, right? So there's not a, even at the height of his fame, there's not a lot of fanfare about him being out places. So he's at this bar and he's alone and he looks kind of glum. And so Ingrid's like, I guess this is my shot to meet Prince. But she's being coy. She passes him a note that says basically to smile, and this will start a friendship and a partnership.
And if you know anything about Prince, you might know in the mid-80s, he has this project he abandons, which he refers to called the Black Album, which, by the way, everyone come at me, better than Jay-Z's Black Album. I said it, and there it is, and I loved it, and I had it on cassette. I got it on cassette from that guy that sent me Motley Crue bootlegs in the 80s, like same dude. Oh my God.
So this is the totally unreleased thing. Like, it never gets actually released, right?
No, they pressed it. Like, it was being pressed, and then Prince wanted it pulled.
And
he didn't. Yeah.
He does it that night that he meets Ingrid, is the story. It's like, yeah, after he meets her, he calls Warner Brothers and tells them he's not going to be finishing or releasing the Black Album. That's a pretty massive outcome. Even if we just stopped here and there was nothing else about Ingrid Chavez, the fact that she was kind of a catalyst for that to happen is wild.
Yeah, there's major outputs from this partnership, friendship, relationship, whatever the hell it is. And one of them, of course, is Graffiti Bridge, which sucks compared to the Black Album. But that's just my opinion. But what Prince first seems interested in from Ingrid is her ability to write words, poetry.
Yeah, it seems that their relationship, because it starts in this bar with her writing to him, they keep that cadence, and so she will write poems to him for a while and notes, even though they live in the same town. I think they see each other somewhat regularly, and he really sees her as this creator and this poet. And this is key to the story, because as their creative partnership develops, Prince is going to challenge Ingrid to write poems. And at one point he says to her, this is how she tells the story, I need you to write 21 poems, and if you do that, we'll create an album together where you read the poems and I'll provide the music.
Right. So during this time, Prince and Ingrid are both spending tons of time in this newly constructed place, which is like his castle, his Graceland, much cooler than not having green shag carpet and being this little tiny place, Paisley Park. And Ingrid is working on this poetry collaboration. And Prince is simultaneously working on what will become Love Sexy. And to this day, Ingrid likes to talk about those two albums as mirrors to each other.
Here's where the threads of our story come together. This is Ingrid in another long-form interview with The Current, and you can find this in the show notes. Quote, when we were filming Graffiti Bridge, Prince one night asked me if I wanted to go see Lenny Kravitz play at First Avenue.
How cool is all that? Can you imagine Prince going, I want to go see Lenny Kravitz tonight at First Avenue? Like, what a weird thing.
And now, two-thirds of our story is in the same room, right? I'm continuing her telling the story here. This is Ingrid. He had a driver take us, and Lenny was playing, and we were hanging out, and then he was tired and wanted to go. And Lenny was only halfway through his set, so I rode with him back. He told the driver to take me home, but as soon as Prince got out of the car, I said, don't do that. Take me back to First Avenue. I'm going to continue to watch the end of this show. So when I get back there, I think Lenny was already finished, but I go backstage to meet him because we happen to have a mutual friend, and we became friends that night, and we started hanging out whenever I'd be in L.A. or whenever he was in New York. We would connect, and one time when I was in L.A., he was in the studio with a guy named Andre Betts, and they invited me. They were laying down a beat, and he laid down a synth line, and then he said, hey, Ingrid, do you have anything to add here? And I said, quote, I have a letter. I guess I could just go ahead and read the letter.
And the letter, of course, becomes the lyrics for Justify My Love. Mm. And just a refresher on some of those, I want to kiss you in Paris. Ooh. I want to hold your hand in Rome.
Ah.
I want to run naked in a rainstorm. Make love in a train cross country. You put this in me. Ooh. So now what? Now what? This story has gotten really tortured by the internet. And hooray for the internet for destroying something else. You'll often see that this letter she reads is a love letter to Lenny Kravitz, or that they were having an affair.
Now, as is often the case on the show, I don't know. I mean, we can't be the final arbiters of the truth here. We are not Lenny Kravitz or Ingrid, and they're really the only two people that know if they had an affair. When Ingrid talks about this now, though, she does not talk about it as an outgrowth of a romantic relationship with Lenny. You will read a lot of places, like you just said, that this was a love letter she wrote to Lenny. This, I do not think that's true. She will just refer to this as a letter she'd been carrying around, plausibly part of her poetry projects. But there are some things that could make you think that it was a tad bit more personal.
Continuing with the way Ingrid tells the story, here's more from that interview. A little while later, no one told me that this was going to be for anybody but me. This was my song.
Uh-oh.
So a little while, I heard Madonna was going to be doing it, and that they didn't want anyone to know that I had written it.
What?
I got kind of talked into being a ghostwriter of it.
She also says here, quote, the way that Madonna sings, it's exactly the way it was laid down by me. So she just basically went in and put her voice on top of mine.
So if she really is responsible for all the lyrics, why did she agree to be uncredited in a ghostwriter?
So it depends on who you ask. Again, this is he said, she said bullshit. We're going to Lenny, 1991. He tells the Associated Press, quote, Ingrid had written some of the lyrics on the verses for certain personal and professional reasons. Air quotes. At the time, we agreed not to put her name on it. We signed a contract and she gets royalties. It became a big hit and she tried to make like she did the whole thing.
I love it. It's drama weird, he said, she said stuff.
It's so weird. And
it's always about the he said, she said bullshit.
Yeah, it is, Fred.
Everybody sucks and everything's fucked.
Okay, so one way to read that, of course, which I do think you can make a strong argument for this, is that they were having an affair. And this is towards the end of the Lisa Bonet marriage. So that marriage dissolves in like 91 or 92, and this is 89, 90. So like things could be on the rocks. It could be troublesome. And then he is spending time with her, and or maybe this leads to the being the final straw. Who knows? There's another way to read it, though, and basically not change anything, which is that Lenny's worried about his marriage. And maybe they didn't have a relationship, but he does not want this basically sex song to be for her to know he co-wrote it with a random person that she doesn't know, right? So,
right.
You know, I mean, especially when you're like, well, how do you know? Well, she's like a protege of Prince's. Like, right? Like, none of that is going to be something that would make your female partner feel comfortable in that situation. So you could argue it either way, and I don't know which one is true.
Yeah, and this is what Ingrid will say was going on. She told USA Today, quote, I agreed not to tell because he was afraid his wife would think that we had a relationship going, end quote.
Ah, well, okay, there you go. So the real question becomes, why the change of heart? Why does she decide to go back and end up suing Lenny? Because that's what happens. She will go back and sue him over lack of credit on the song. And so, in short, the answer as to why she changes her mind, according to her, is because Prince is pissed.
Blouses. This is Ingrid in that interview again. As soon as it came out that Prince called me up and immediately said, Ingrid, what's up with that Madonna song, Justify My Love? That's you. I know it's you. I hear your voice. It's you. And that was the first time I told anybody about it. And he was totally upset.
This blows my mind. So according to Ingrid, to hear her tell the story, she does not tell Prince that she's been working with Lenny Kravitz. He presumably gets in the car one day when this song comes out, hears the tune, and is like, well, clearly Madonna just ripped off Ingrid, and calls Ingrid and is like, what the hell did you do? Why does Madonna have basically a song that is yours hanging out there, right? Wild. He's like, you know, she's essentially doing an Ingrid Chavez impression, which she is. And this is when it hits her that this wasn't just a favor that she did for Lenny. This is potentially a nail in the coffin of her own career, which hasn't even gotten started yet. Because Prince articulates something to her that she does not realize, which is what?
He was like, your record's about to come out, and people are going to think that you're copying Madonna.
That's wild. So, that is wild stuff. That he has this foresight to be like, now the cat got out of the bag in the wrong order. Like, you're in trouble.
Yeah, right? So the very next day, this is her, I got lawyers and made sure that did not happen, that Madonna didn't get the credit for writing that, and that it was my song. That's part of what turned me off about the music business being sort of taken advantage of like that.
And when she says turned me off about the music business, she will pretty quickly just leave the music biz.
She does get a settlement out of the lawsuit. I'm not sure if the official terms were released, but it's thought she gets 1/3 of the royalties now.
Yeah, I think originally it was like it was like 12% originally. And so if my numbers are right, I won't swear to that, but I think she goes basically from like 12 to 36% or something. So three times what she was going to get.
Which doesn't suck. And the Ingrid Chavez solo album will come to be called May 19th, 1992, though the creators claim they never officially titled it, and the date was just really a timestamp. There's a link in the show notes, and you have to go to YouTube to
check it out. Yeah, it's not easy to find. And I'll tell you, if you're curious about what this record sounds like, it sounds just like Justify My Love. Clearly, Prince was right. Like, Madonna puts this out, and now you can't hear that and not think about Madonna, even though it was it was before
same time.
Madonna. It was released in 92. Most of her vocals, though, are coming from 1987 poetry reading sessions that she did. So there's this big delay here. And after this, she pretty much quits the music industry, like I said, for at least for the next few decades. Quote, then we kind of just went our separate ways for a while because of all of that controversy that went with Justify My Love. I turned my back on music, married an English musician whose name is Dave Sylvian, and then we went on to make a family, and I lived vicariously through his music. Now, in the last few years, she's reemerged and re-recorded her own version of Justify My Love. Do you want to read? There's an interesting quote, her explaining how this happens, because it seems a little weird that all of a sudden she just records a version of it.
I never intended to perform the song live after all these years later. I just happened to be invited to come to Germany in 2016 to play at a festival. Once I was there with the other guys practicing, they asked, why don't you do a version of Justify My Love? We performed it live, and it was a great success. People loved it. I was asked if I would consider recording a version of it and maybe releasing it.
Well, and it's worth noting as we wrap up this part of the story around who really deserves credit for Justify My Love, is that Ingrid is not the only miffed artist who feels ripped off and will come looking for money in the aftermath of Justify My Love's success. There's someone else.
Flavor Flav, Public Enemy. He's the Flavor Flav, by the way, sponsoring the U.S. water polo team.
Yes, he women's is. Those clips are amazing. Those clips are amazing of Flavor Flav talking about his love for female water sports. Please go look that up. Okay, so according to Public Enemy, they are like, dude, the beat of this song is built on Security of the First World. That's, of course, on It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back.
And if you are familiar with that and you can hear it in your head, you're going like, oh, yeah, that's right. It is the same. Like, it's so similar. And if not, like, check that out. Hit that up, however you listen to music. They do get some press out of this claim, but there is a problem. It is not. It's, of course, it's James Brown's Funky Drummer.
Yeah, so half of hip-hop is built on top of Funky Drummer. So if
That's right.
We've talked about some of the defining samples of hip-hop music. I don't think we've talked about Funky Drummer. Funky Drummer is one of them. There is a drum loop out of Funky Drummer that gets used all over music. So pretty hard to litigate. Now, the guy who produced the song for Public Enemy, he decides he's not going to win this legal battle. So instead, what he does is he takes another band he produces and they write basically an answer to Justify My Love. You may or may not know that this exists. The group is called Young Black Teenagers. And the song is called For My Donna, if you get that play on words, For My Donna. Do you know that song?
I don't.
Yeah. No. So it's an answer track to Justify My Love. So enjoy that. There's one more thing that comes out of Justify My Love, which is a musical genre. Like, a lot of people will call this the beginning of trip hop because it's about 3 years before Massive Attack really breaks through. Even though it's a very messy creation of this song has this huge impact. And I think it's really interesting how imperfect the execution is and how long lasting the impact is. Sometimes you're not gonna think you nailed it, and you nailed it, I guess is what I'm trying to say. This has been a wild ride. Thank you, Marta, for the note. Again, if you want to get involved in the show, it's wearethestoryguys@gmail.com. And if you want to support the show, patreon.com/rockandrollbedtimestories. And please find us on YouTube and Instagram and find our website when you just head to wearethestoryguys.com. And until next time, Murdoch, what should people keep doing?
Keep telling stories.
Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories is a Story Guys production. The show is produced and edited by Brian Eichenberger. Get more stories, hear more podcasts, and book the guys for your conference or house party at wearethestoryguys.com. Copyright Boy Have We Got Stories Productions. All rights reserved.